In previous sessions, we've explored the implications of the research of non-ordinary states of consciousness for the understanding of the human psyche and the dimensions of human consciousness. We've explored the implications for architecture of various emotional and psychosomatic disorders. We looked into the problem of spiritual emergency or psycho-spiritual crisis, and also the implications for the understanding of the psychology of death and dying. In this session, we'll look at the broadest implications, the philosophical, the metaphysical, the spiritual insights into the nature of reality and human nature that emerged from this work. The problem of spiritual experiences in non-ordinary states, and particularly psychedelic states, is a really fascinating subject. We became aware at the very beginning of psychedelic experimentation that psychedelic substances have the capacity to induce experiences which were either identical or very, very closely similar to the kinds of experiences that are described in the spiritual literature of all ages. And actually, from the beginning, there has been very heated discussion about the nature of these experiences. What does it mean that we have a class of substances that can induce what appear to be mystical experiences? And very soon, somehow, the people who were discussing it divided into three large groups. The first group were the sort of hardcore materialistic scientists who were very excited about this phenomenon, and for them it meant that they would be able to prove that mysticism is not an authentic phenomenon, that it's something that can be ultimately reduced to brain anatomy, brain physiology, brain biochemistry, so that what mystics consider to be relevant insights into the nature of reality would be nothing else than sort of artifacts of kind of distorted neurophysiological processes in the brain. The second group of people took a very different position. What they basically felt is that there is a special subgroup of chemical substances that are capable to induce mystical experiences, which means they are not ordinary substances, and they tended to see them as sacraments, basically taking the position of shamans from native cultures, who of course don't have psychedelic substances, but they have psychedelic plants, and they tend to sort out, tease out this group of psychedelic substances and refer to them as sacred plants, as flesh of the gods. And then there was a third group who had yet another perspective. They had to admit that phenomenologically, the states induced by psychedelic substances and the so-called spontaneous mystical states are indistinguishable. But they sort of maintained that they are not equally valid or valuable, that in order to have genuine mystical spiritual experiences, these have to come as a result of some kind of systematic spiritual practice, of kind of ascetic procedures of some kind, or they have to come spontaneously as an expression of grace. Now, unfortunately, the people who would be judging this, which is basically spiritual teachers, got divided on this issue, whether or not these experiences are genuine. For example, I have done some work with Tibetan masters who had psychedelic experiences. For example, Chögyam Trungpa, Lama Govinda, and others had psychedelic experiences. And generally, they agreed that psychedelic substances are very important catalysts or accelerators of spiritual practice, but emphasized that they have to be used with tremendous care. There were other people in the spiritual realm who were violently opposed. The main opponent, for example, was Mer Baba, who wrote a little pamphlet called God in the Pill. And scholar Zehner from Boston, who also wrote a book about drugs and mysticism, where he was really violently opposed to the idea that it is possible somehow to induce genuine mystical experiences using chemical means. This was different, for example, from the position of another scholar, Houston Smith, who had psychedelic experiences himself and who really saw the positive potential for psychedelics in the spiritual practice. The most interesting work that was done in terms of showing the phenomenological similarity between this sort of what's called instant or chemical mysticism and the mystical experiences described in spiritual literature was the work of Walter Pahnke, who, as a student at Harvard, did a dissertation which has become known as the Good Friday experiment. He was allowed to do this experiment in the Harvard chapel on Good Friday, and he invited a group of students of theology who were given on a double-blind basis either psilocybin or niacin, which was considered to be placebo. Niacin would basically create sort of feelings of heat and itching in the skin so that people would have a sense that something's happening. Walter also developed this questionnaire about peak experience or mystical experience, which he extracted from mystical literature. And he used this somehow to get a standardized report from the students about their experiences. And he showed basically that there was absolutely no difficulty in distinguishing who had psilocybin and who had placebo. But he also found out that he wasn't able to distinguish the mystical experiences that the students were describing from those that are known from mystical literature. So this is a very, very interesting and very open question. I was aware from the very beginning about this potential of psychedelic substances, both from my own experience and from what I knew from other people. For example, Tim Leary, Richard Alpert, or Ramdas, and Ralph Metzner, in their first book on psychedelics, explicitly used the Bardo Tödö, the Tibetan Book of the Dead, and compared it somehow to psychedelic experiences. The book was called The Psychedelic Experience, a manual based on the Tibetan Book of the Dead. But for me, this whole problem became very interesting and kind of personalized by a very, very unusual experience which I had with a Siddha yogi, Swami Muktananda. When my today's wife, Christina, and I met in 1975 and became to work and live together, she was at the time a very ardent follower of Swami Muktananda, whom she had met in Honolulu during his first trip around the world, at a time when the circle of his followers was still very, very small, very narrow. And as we were living in Big Sur, Muktananda came to Oakland, to the Oakland ashram, and was offering intensives and also darshans. And Christina really wanted me to meet Muktananda, so she arranged a darshan. She very likely wanted to know if her guru would give approval to our relationship. I was working with LSD, I was not a vegetarian, I enjoyed sex, so I think she had some doubts to what extent this would be acceptable to the guru. So she arranged this darshan, and both of us drove from Big Sur to Oakland. And I have to say, I wasn't very excited about this meeting, because some of my friends who had been in intensives with Muktananda came as kind of converted devotees. There was one instance where a person who was an Esalen workshop leader attended an intensive with Muktananda and then came back to Esalen doing an Esalen workshop. And instead of doing what he had promised in the catalog, he wanted the group to spend a lot of time chanting Om Namah Shivaya and talk about Siddha Yoga and Kashmir Shaivism. And there was a kind of a negative reaction where people wanted their money back and so on. But I thought it would be very interesting to meet, you know, a Siddha Yogi. So as we were traveling, we were talking, Christina was telling me various stories about Muktananda. And then we came about maybe 15 minutes early, and we parked the car. And just at that point, Christina told me that Muktananda was a Shaivite, and that really attracted my attention, because I considered Shiva to be a kind of archetype that was very, very close to me. I had actually some of my most powerful experiences in connection with the figure of Shiva. And so as we were sitting there in the car, I told her about two my most powerful experiences with Shiva. One was the experience that I described in the book, The Adventure of Self-Discovery, when I gave my own examples of the different perinatal matrices, where in the context of the experience of ego death, I had this major encounter with Shiva in his destructive aspect as a figure that was mediating the ego death experience. And then years later, I had an experience in which I saw a powerful kind of archetypal river that was flowing back to the cosmic source, which I could also see as this sort of incredible furnace of creative energy and consciousness and so on. And I saw sort of everything, all of creation, being called back to the source. I saw the dinosaurs sort of originating as a species and then living for a certain time and then sort of going into this river of time and disappearing in it. And I saw dynasties coming and going and so on. And there was a very compelling kind of a chant that was happening. And I saw a very powerful image of the dancing Shiva, Shiva Nataraja, as a kind of a symbol of this cosmic dance. So those are very, very powerful experiences. So I described it in some details to Christina, and then it was time to go to meet Muktananda. So we crossed the street, walked into the ashram, and walked directly into the room where we had this darshan. And there was Muktananda sitting on a kind of throne with a ski cap on his head, dark glasses, in a kind of orange robe, the lungi, holding a wand of peacock feathers, scented with sandal oil, and sort of hitting people over the head. As we came in, he immediately invited me. There was an empty chair by his side. He asked me to sit down, and then he lifted his dark glasses, which he very seldom did, and he turned my head and was looking into my eyes from a couple of inches, like an ophthalmologist, sort of very, very carefully studying my eyes. And then the first thing that he said was, "I can tell you're a man who has seen Shiva." He said, "This is very good." And this just absolutely blew my mind, because I just spent, you know, about 10, 15 minutes talking about my experiences with Shiva, which he, of course, had no way of knowing. And then we started a discussion where we basically talked about psychedelic substances. He said, "Well, I understand you work with LSD. We do something similar here, only we don't use drugs. And the difference is that with the drugs, people go out there and they come back. Whereas in our kind of work, you know, when people get up there, they stay there." And then he discussed the use of bhang by the Brahmins. And I asked the questions about soma. I was very interested in the problem of soma, which was a plant and a sacred beverage made of this plant that was used as a Vedic sacrament and was very likely the source of all Vedic religion. And of course, that botanical secret has been lost, so we don't know which plant it was and, of course, what the chemical agents were. And he told me that the secret was still known, and that during his birthday, the Vedic priests come from the mountains and actually have a soma ceremony, and that Christina and I could come and participate in it. So it seemed like this whole thing would be a kind of a professional discussion. We were kind of in a similar business. And then suddenly, without any transition, he reached behind himself where there was a big pink can of almond roca and fished out sort of two pieces of almond roca, unwrapped them very quickly, shoved them into my mouth, and then started hitting me, you know, quite hard with his hand, slapping me on the right cheek and left cheek, and then hitting my forehead, and then also kicking me in the shin, and did this for a while, and then just stopped and, you know, without any explanation, sort of stood up, and it was clear that the interview was over. And so we were walking out of this room, and then in the door, you know, we were saying goodbye, and he looked at us and said, "We will have two consecutive weekends. We'll have intensives on Kashmir Shaivism, and I invite you both as my guests." And then he looked at me kind of very meaningfully and said, "This is going to be very interesting for you." And so we walked out, and there was a kind of a gauntlet of people from the ashram and people from the outside waiting for us to get out. They were mostly people who had done some psychedelics, and they were curious whether during our darshan this issue came up. So they were asking questions like, did you talk about acid? Did Baba think acid was okay? And so on. And I didn't feel like discussing anything with anybody. I felt something strange was kind of churning inside. So I brushed them off and walked across this large hall in the ashram and ended up on the opposite side. Was my back in the corner and in a lotus position, and I wanted to know what was happening. So I closed my eyes, and something very interesting happened. I knew intellectually that I was given Shaktipat, but I didn't believe that something like that could have impact on me. I thought, you know, you would have to take something powerful to actually have a compelling experience. I knew psychedelics could do it. I also knew something intellectually about Kundalini and Kundalini Yoga, but my kind of predominant image of the response to Shaktipat was some kind of dramatic reaction, like shaking, sort of streaming of energy, involuntary sounds coming, waves of emotion, and so on. What's called kriyas in the tantric tradition. But that's not what happened to me. As soon as I closed my eyes, I suddenly was in a state of absolute, really profound, cosmic emptiness, nothingness. Like the closest thing would be like being halfway between here and Pluto, sort of in the interstellar space. But there was more to it. I mean, there was consciousness there, and there was a sense that this was a kind of primordial nothingness out of which all creation comes. And I also had a sense of arriving of just incredible peace and sort of all questions answered, or no need to ask questions, which is the same. When I opened my eyes, I found out that 2.5 hours passed where I was in this state of emptiness. So again, I was quite impressed by what just had happened. And of course, we decided to go to this seminar on Kashmir Shaivism. And so we came to Oakland, and the seminar was opened by one of the Swamis of Muktananda, whose name was Swami Tejo, who gave us a little of the history of Kashmir Shaivism. This is a system that started in Srinagar, which is the capital of Kashmir, in the 8th century AD, when a Kashmiri sage had some visions that directed him to some rocks on the outskirts of Srinagar, where after he exposed some vegetation, he found some ancient carvings, which today are known as the Shiva Sutras, as the basic spiritual manual of Kashmir Shaivism. And of course, nobody knew how long it had been there before this person found it. And then Swami Tejo started describing some of the basic principles, basic ideas of Kashmir Shaivism. And as he talked, I was becoming kind of increasingly paranoid, because as far as I was concerned, he was stealing a paper of mine that I had written a couple of years earlier. At that time, I became interested in mystical experiences that people had in psychedelic sessions, and spent a long time analyzing these protocols from psychedelic sessions, extracting somehow those parts of their accounts where they were describing some basic ontological or cosmological, metaphysical insights. And I was astounded that what was emerging out of it was not like a mosaic of kind of idiosyncratic distortions of understanding of reality, but that there was consensus, that people basically were experiencing different aspects of one encompassing, overarching vision of reality, which was fundamentally different from the one that we have in our Western industrial civilization. But at the same time, you know, there was really a fundamental agreement among these people who had non-ordinary states on some very, very basic aspects of this vision. What was even more peculiar, as he was talking, he was using a variety of similes and metaphors, and those were, you know, really taken from my paper. So it took me a while before I realized that he was not stealing my paper, but that there was this astonishing parallel somehow between Kashmir Shaivism and this vision of reality that emerged out of the psychedelic research. which was quite peculiar, because one system was based on some ancient carvings that were found in Kashmir in the 8th century. The other system was based on accounts of people who had experiences with this substance that was by accident discovered in Swiss pharmaceutical laboratories. And of course the question was, how is this possible? What is the common denominator here? And the only answer that I could find is that obviously this has to be coming from the deep levels of the human psyche, and that, you know, we are talking about the same kinds of experiences that were just elicited by different kinds of triggers. And so then over the years, I was interested in this area. I was accumulating more and more observations from psychedelic sessions. And then when we moved to the holotropic breathwork, I found out that basically identical insights and experiences were happening in that context. So now recently I wrote a book which is called The Cosmic Game, Explorations of the Frontiers of Human Consciousness, which is now based not just on the observations from psychedelic sessions, but also from the holotropic breathwork. Also, experiences from people who had spontaneous psycho-spiritual crisis, spiritual emergencies. So this is what I would like to explore in this session. The work now is based on more than 5,000 records from psychedelic sessions and a large number of sessions in the holotropic breathwork. I counted the other day and I found out that we have conducted over the years about 35,000 holotropic sessions with people. Of course, those were not individual sessions. Those were done in groups, and some of them very large groups, several hundred people at a time. So I saw them in the process. I am not familiar with all the specifics of the inner experience because the sharing frequently happened in small groups. But if there were some interesting experiences, the facilitators of those groups would certainly bring them to me. So it's based on a large number of observations and experiences. The first thing I was interested in during this analysis, you know, looking for the metaphysical insights from non-ordinary states, was I was asking about the goal of the spiritual journey. People quite independently reported when they were doing repeated sessions that they saw this whole procedure as a kind of continuous spiritual quest. And then, of course, the question arose, what is the goal of the journey? What are the kinds of experiences where people have the feeling that they have arrived, that they have gotten what they were looking for? Or are there experiences like that, that people really see as facing the ultimate? So I was looking specifically at the different forms of the experiences of the divine and what they have to offer to people who experience them. So we have already discussed the whole category of transpersonal experiences. The first category of transpersonal experiences can be referred to as the experiences of the immanent divine, which means seeing the divine somehow in the everyday reality. When we have experiences like that, we look around and we see the world not as this kind of the ordinary Newtonian materialistic reality, but basically as a kind of a divine mystery. We see the cosmic creative energy at work in the world around us. And we can also directly perceive the unity which underlies the world of separation. We can experience, as I described before, consciousness of other people, of groups of people. We can experience consciousness of different animals. We can experience consciousness associated with plants and inorganic processes. Now, if we have these experiences, what it does for us is that we move from the concept of living in an ordinary material world to the realization that we live in a world which is created by cosmic intelligence, by cosmic creative energy. And we can suddenly understand the animistic worldview that is found in many native cultures. I remember, for example, a report that I got from a person who had hiked in the Sierra mountains and had a powerful non-ordinary experience. And at one point he was lying on a big slab of granite with his feet sort of in this stream, and he had the experience of the boundaries of his body merging, and he became one with the granite and experienced what he felt was consciousness of granite. He became aware of the fact that there is a certain quality of consciousness associated with granite, a state of consciousness which is kind of imperturbable, eternal. It takes millions of years before the surface of granite is corroded by weather. For much of the time, the granite is there, unchangeable, while the biological life in the biosphere is undergoing, you know, tremendous kind of mercurial changes. Species originate and are extinct, and dynasties rule and are replaced and so on. So he experienced this consciousness of granite as this consciousness of a Buddha figure that sits there on the immovable spot while the whole history of the world sort of passes by. Other people experience consciousness of a sequoia tree. Again, you know, the sequoia tree is 3,000, sometimes 4,000 years old. And so when we look at this cut through the sequoia tree, we see, you know, pretty close to the surface, Columbus discovers America, and then a little further, you know, crucifixion of Christ and so on. And we realize that this tree has been there as a witness of all these centuries. So that's one form of consciousness where we see the universe as ensouled, as permeated by consciousness and this divine intelligence. Another form of experience is the experience of the transcendental divine, where we would become aware of realities which are not normally available to us in any form. It's not just that we see the everyday reality somehow radically transformed, but we see certain realities of which we are not aware in everyday life. Just another dimension kind of unfolds into this reality. We encounter archetypal beings, deities, demons, or we become them, or we experience visits to some archetypal realms. So in this situation, suddenly we start understanding the position of some native and pre-industrial cultures that saw the universe as inhabited by gods, by deities, by superior forces. And we understand that those were not some kind of superstitious beliefs, but that they were based on a direct experience of these archetypal realities. Now, the interesting thing is that we can experience deities from any culture of the world, even deities that belong to a different racial group, to a different cultural group, or that might be specific for another historical period. These days, the collective unconscious is really widely accessible to us. I've experienced in my psychedelic sessions deities from a variety of cultures, Tibetan deities, Hindu deities, Egyptian deities, Zoroastrian deities, Australian Aboriginal deities, Shinto deities, and so on. And I've seen the same in many people that I have worked with. Now, we can experience these deities, and as we experience them, we become aware of the fact that they are powerful entities, that they exist on another level of reality, and they are endowed with tremendous energies, and we can have a powerful reaction to them, depending on the nature of the deity. This could be anything from abysmal terror to feelings of ultimate grace and cosmic bliss. But if we are sort of sensitive observers, we will not experience these deities as the supreme principle in the universe, as the ultimate. We'll see them as beings that belong to a higher order, to a dimension that sort of forms and informs this one, but they themselves are creations of a principle that transcends them. And this is a very important issue in the world of religion. Joseph Campbell used to say, and I think he took it from Graf Durkheim, actually, he used to say that a useful and genuine deity should be transparent for the transcendent. In other words, we should see it as something that reveals the existence of the supreme principle and in a way kind of points to it or is a doorway to it, but it's not the ultimate principle itself. And Joseph Campbell very much warned against making the deities opaque, because then there's a danger of idolatry, which means we sort of relate to a particular set of archetypal images which would be different from the archetypal images that are the object of worship of another group. And this kind of approach tends to unite people within their own range, but then set that group against another one, and we have a divided world where these groups are trying to either convert each other or exterminate each other. So in today's world, the organized religions are certainly part of the problem. They are not part of the solution. What we need is a spirituality which is universal, which is ecumenical, which is all-encompassing, not the one that represents a dangerous division in the world. Again, the fascinating thing is that when we have these experiences, we can get new insights and new information about archetypal realms, showing that somehow the archetypal worlds exist objectively and independently. This basically confirms the Jungian perspective. These are similar observations to those that led Jung to the assumption that besides the individual unconscious, we have also the collective unconscious, which in a way sort of mediates access to the entire cultural heritage of humanity. So we can have experiences of deities that we had absolutely no intellectual knowledge of. They can be from cultures that we don't know. In my book, The Cosmic Game, I have probably the most interesting observation of this kind as an illustration. And this is something that happened during my work in the Research Institute in Prague, where I was treating a patient with severe claustrophobia. And in one of his sessions, he suddenly had a vision of a very scary, very ominous kind of entry into the underworld, which was guarded by a pig goddess, by a goddess in the shape of a pig. And at that point, when he had the vision, he suddenly opened his eyes and he demanded that I bring some paper and some drawing utensils. He needed to draw, and then spent quite a while with a kind of compulsive drawing of some complex kind of geometrical figures, and he was never satisfied with it. He was kind of crumpling the paper and was throwing it all over the room. And this was a very, very powerful episode. And at that time, I was still under the influence of Freudian analysis quite a bit, and I spent a long time doing free associations and trying to understand what this was about, and we didn't really get very far. So the process then moved to some other areas, and I didn't understand what this episode meant. Then when I came to the United States, at one point, quite early during my stay, I connected with Joseph Campbell, and we became really close friends. Joseph Campbell is considered by many the greatest mythologist of this century, or possibly the greatest mythologist who has ever lived. He used to come to Esalen regularly and have dinner with us and participated in many of our month-longs and other workshops. And I always had a list prepared for him of observations of various archetypal beings and realities that I didn't understand. And he was this incredible walking encyclopedia of the world mythology. And in most instances, he had no problems identifying the deities. So during one of these dinners, I remembered this episode from Prague, and I told him the story. And he said, oh, this is fascinating. This obviously was the devouring mother night of the Malekulans, which is a tribe in New Guinea, and then described what this tribe was about, that there was a cult of pigs in this culture, and that boys were breeding these pigs, and they had rites of passage, puberty rites, in which they would ritually kill the pig, and the pig represented the mother. So it was a kind of a ritual separation of the bond to the mother. And this culture also has the image of the great mother in the shape of a pig, and they believe that she guards the entry into the underworld, and they practice during their lifetime drawing of this specific, very, very intricate and complex labyrinth, and they believe that during the posthumous journey of the soul, when they die, they come to this entry into the underworld, and they had to demonstrate to the pig goddess that they can draw this specific labyrinth, otherwise they couldn't make the passage. So this was quite an amazing kind of a confirmation, verification, and, you know, identification of an experience that at the time looked very obscure. So we have the possibility of experiencing these archetypal figures, and as I mentioned before, we don't see them as being somehow the supreme in the universe, but more expressions or manifestations of the supreme. So now the most important question that we can ask in this kind of research is, what is the experience that people consider to be the experience of the supreme? How do they experience the ultimate principle in the universe? So I searched the accounts of people for the experience that really was fully satisfying, that for them meant the end of the spiritual search. And I found two experiences like that. The first experience was surprisingly the experience of primordial emptiness, nothingness, but kind of nothingness that was conscious of the fact that there was nothing there, and it was at the same time associated with the feeling that nothing is missing, and that this primordial emptiness is the cradle of existence, that somehow it is responsible for the creation of the phenomenal worlds. Now it's important to emphasize that this is a very special kind of experience of emptiness. You know, there are other ways of experiencing emptiness in non-ordinary states, which is not the supracosmic, metacosmic void. We can have just the feeling that we are empty, which means we don't experience any initiative, emotions. We feel kind of emotionally extinct. This is a very specific kind of experience of emptiness, which has those characteristics that I mentioned. This is a state that transcends polarities, such as good and evil, feminine, masculine, in a sense even emptiness and form. The way we can understand it is that this emptiness is also a plenum. We don't see anything concrete, but we also are aware of the fact that there is a potential for all of creation. So everything that's part of the phenomenal worlds is already present in this emptiness in a potential form. It's interesting that the modern physicists have a kind of a similar concept. They talk about the dynamic vacuum, and in high energy experiments where there are collisions of particles and so on, they can actually observe virtual particles emerging out of this dynamic vacuum, and again particles disappearing in this vacuum. Of course, there's also a fundamental difference between the dynamic vacuum of the physicists and this kind of supracosmic, metacosmic void, because the physicists are talking only about the origin of the particles as kind of fundamental building blocks for the universe, whereas when we experience the supracosmic void, it's also the key to the understanding of things like the logos of creation, the origin of order, and the secret of forms, of patterns, and so on, which of course is beyond the reach of physicists. The world is full of forms that differ from each other, you know, many different people belonging to many different races, many species of animals, many minerals, many plants, and so on. And of course, experiments in high energy physics have nothing to contribute to the understanding of this aspect of the universe. The second experience in which people had the sense of facing the supreme was quite different from this one. The closest that we can say about it is that it appears to be like this incredibly bright, incandescent source of light. People usually say it's like, you know, millions of suns and so on. It's more powerful than anything they could even imagine, let alone experience in our everyday state of consciousness. So they frequently compare it to light or the cosmic sun, but at the same time they usually emphasize that if we talk about it just as source of light, we're still missing some very significant aspects of this experience. For example, when we have that experience, we are aware of the fact that this is also a field, infinite field of consciousness, endowed with a certain kind of personality, endowed with incredible intelligence and creative potential. But yet something like our sun is the closest thing that we can come up with when we want to find some ways of describing this experience of the Supreme. And again, when we have that experience, we have the feeling that it transcends polarities. We can't say whether it's divine or demonic, whether it's good or evil, whether it's masculine or feminine. But at the same time, we feel that that is the author of creation. This is where creation comes from. And many people even experience a kind of a interesting relationship between the supracosmic void and this other manifestation of the divine, where they actually can witness this radiant divine emerging out of the void or returning into the void. When we have that experience, we don't have the feeling of the absurdity, because something is coming out of nothing or something is disappearing into nothingness. There is a sense of self-evidence about it. Some people say it was like an aha experience. Suddenly we understand how something can come out of nothing.